to episode 44 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. Thank you for joining us. We are lawyers talking about technology, security, privacy, and government. And I'm joined today by Michael Vadas, formerly with the FBI and the Justice Department, now a partner in Steptoe's New York office. Jason Weinstein, formerly with the Justice Department, where he oversaw criminal computer crime prosecutions, among other things, and now doing criminal and civil litigation at Steptoe. Our guest commentator is Sal Stolfo, a professor at Columbia University's Computer Science Department and the CEO of Allure Software. And finally, I'm Stuart Baker, formerly with NSA and DHS, and the record holder for returning to Steptoe to practice law more times than any other lawyer. So let's get started. This week in NSA, we have a couple of interesting topics. One, will the 215 program, the NSA metadata program, ever die? Everyone has been assuming, then the conventional wisdom was, well, yes, on June 1 of 2015, the sunset runs out and the program dies. And that was a pretty good bet, except for a New York Times article that actually I found pretty persuasive that went to the notes on Section 215, in particular explaining how the sunset was supposed to work. And the notes, which are part of the law but which weren't codified into the U.S. Code, say that this will be effective until June 1, 2015, and then it adds a little transition provision, except that former provisions to continue in effect with respect to any particular foreign intelligence investigation that began before June 1, 2015, or with respect to any particular offense or potential offense that began or occurred before June 1, 2015. So what this means, I think, is that, there is a transition period. You would not want to be in the middle of an investigation, having gathered most of your information on an important case, a few more bits of information still to gather, and to have the authority under which you've been gathering all of that information expire, potentially causing claims that all the information you've already collected under past authorities is also invalid. So it makes sense, I think, for Congress to say, yes, there is a transition, and you can continue to rely on this statute for certain investigations. But in the context of 215, yeah.
Doesn't it actually sweep far more broadly than that, potentially, at least if the administration wants it to? Because the whole theory that both the Bush and Obama administrations have utilized for 215 is that they can get all metadata because it's all relevant to an investigation or all investigations, basically. So under this transition clause, this same omnibus investigation is going to continue forever. At least that's the theory. It's like the AUMF after 9/11. You know, we're going to continue to go after Al-Qaeda and anyone who, you know, might have talked to someone from Al-Qaeda from now till kingdom come.
I think that's right. It has a lot in common with the AUMF in that it is strikingly convenient and therefore may well be relied upon. I think what's going on here is you had a sensible transition provision that imagined that the authorities that were used under 215 would come with an investigation attached. And you'd be able to tell when that investigation began and ended. But in the context of essentially gathering all the data, holding on to it for an investigation to be named later, they are raising the prospect that as long as there's one investigation, and I would have thought an investigation into Al-Qaeda would be an obvious one investigation that's likely to generate additional calls on this data, then you can keep running 215 and collecting this data for years.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see whether the administration wants to rely on this. The Times article strangely seem to suggest that they weren't aware of this little wrinkle. And they, you know, they might wish that they'd remained ignorant of it, because I would think, given the president's statement about ending the program or modifying the program, that they may not want to take advantage of this, but that'll leave them in a little bit vulnerable position, I think, on the Hill.
I think it's very hard for them to refuse to rely on it, but I think they'll be very tempted to do that. The idea of invoking this, I mean, the president is already on the hook for weird interpretations of the AUMF, and he's taking a lot of abuse from his base. He'd take even more if he had an AUMF-style interpretation of this transition provision. So I think we're going to have a significant debate about this, and it probably means that what had looked like a brick wall of June 1, 2015, is going to start looking more permeable. And it may be that if Congress can't reach agreement on a solution, they may press the administration to rely on these kind of kludgy extensions of the authority. Now, it's also true, I think, they're going to have resistance from the FISA court. So the FISA court may say that's just too creative for us, and that may bring a quick end to the program as well. But I'm not sure. I think the language is pretty persuasive that you can continue the database for this purpose. So that's the news this week in NSA. The other point that I think probably is interesting is that Mike Rogers gave a tour of the horizon from a cybersecurity point of view, and it was pretty troubling, essentially saying it's just a matter of when, not if, our power grid and other essential industrial control systems are attacked, that China and a couple of other countries have the capability to attack them and presumably to bring them down. This is a very big deal. If and when it happens, there are going to be a lot of questions about why we didn't respond to these warnings. I think Rogers is going to say, I couldn't have been more explicit. But Congress, the administration are going to take some heat if they haven't been pressing hard to avoid this kind of an attack. And I think they probably feel they've done as much as they can today politically, but the politics will change if there really is such an attack. And Rogers, I guess, has pretty much insulated himself from being the one who takes the blame if that happens. All right, let's turn to kind of recaps of past stories. Insicam, insecure camera, did a massive criminal confession recently, demonstrating that they had broken into thousands of online cameras using default passwords. We concluded that that was a violation of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act on a massive scale, and now they've brought down all of the network. So I assume they figured out that they were running into mass liability themselves.
Yeah, so much for my attempt to get a new client out of this whole thing.
Nice try. That's Jason Weinstein speaking. Jason Weinstein, for all of you, just look for him on www.step2.com.
So this may only be a one-week story. We talked about it last week, and you just gave a nice recap of it. But the developments over the course of the week were actually perhaps as interesting as the story originally was itself. Privacy commissioners from a number of different countries, including Australia and Canada, the U.K., and Macau, of all places, sent an email to Insicam asking it to take down the site based on the privacy violations. The FTC issued a warning to users that they should make sure they have strong passwords and encryption on their video feeds. And a researcher in Germany who refused to give his real name has said he's identified the developer of the site, who he believes to be a Moldovan man, through some pretty clever online detective work that is sort of too long for the time we have allowed. And the site, which was hosted in Russia, as you said, is now down. And according to a news report I saw yesterday, the developer is actually using the site to broadcast the fact that he's now looking for a job. So if you go to Instacam, you no longer will see people's webcam videos with their children sleeping, but you'll see a notice that says programmer looking for good remote job and then listing his programming credentials.
Well, maybe you could just ask him to put your credentials up too in case they need whoever it is needs a lawyer.
You kill two birds with one stone.
Exactly. Okay, and what's happening in the Wyndham litigation? It looked to me as though something was going on, but I'm not sure how much it really turns out to be.
Well, I think this falls under the this week in waste of time category. The last week, the federal judge who's presiding over the case ordered the parties to go to mediation, which is going to be overseen by a former chief judge of the District Court of New Jersey. As our regular listeners know, back in April, the district judge ruled against Wyndham on its motion to dismiss and held that the FTC could, in fact, go forward with its action against Wyndham for allegedly unreasonable security measures based on three data breaches between 2008 and 2010. Wyndham, as you know, had argued that the FTC couldn't enforce security regulations that didn't exist, and that if Wyndham didn't issue data security regulations, it was unfair to go after companies for failing to adopt reasonable cybersecurity. That issue is now certified for interlocutory appeal by the district judge, and an argument is taking place in the Third Circuit, and we're all waiting for the Third Circuit to rule. But the court, nevertheless, while waiting for the Third Circuit to decide this issue, ordered the parties to mediation. And given the fact that the central issue in the case is the FTC's authority to act, I think it's a waste of everybody's time to send them to mediation. It seems impossible for me to imagine they will be able to resolve this through a negotiation.
Yeah, this is a matter of principle for both of them. And now they've litigated it, so trying to mediate what remains is sort of hopeless.
And why don't you stop litigating now?
Right. Maybe if he sends it to mitigation, it doesn't count against his backlog, and he's trying to hang on to trying to avoid having too long a backlog. What about the trustee case?
So the trustee case is more interesting. You know, as most internet users know, trustee provides privacy certifications, privacy seals for e-commerce websites that meet certain privacy standards, part of a sort of a self-regulatory regime that e-commerce sites have engaged in. And the FTC alleged that over a period of 7 years, from 2006 to 2013, the company engaged in deceptive trade practices. It seems a company with the name Trust in the title would be one that you would not want to engage in deceptive trade practices.
Oh yeah, this is a real blow. I remember actually I was in the room when this was originally started at a computer fraud, computer freedom and privacy event, where everybody got together and said consumers need some kind of seal that tells them what the practices of the website are, and the whole point was we'll be a trusted third party.
Right, and the FTC says they weren't in two ways. First, on its website, Trustee says that any company with its seal gets recertified on an annual basis. And the FTC said that there were about 1,000 cases or more in which Trustee actually failed to do an annual recertification before allowing the company to keep the seal. And second, they said that the company sort of facilitated misrepresentations about its for-profit status, that until 2008, Trustee was a nonprofit company, switched to a for-profit company after 2008. And even though the Trustee had given model language to companies to use to describe Trustee in their privacy policies, describing it as a non-for-profit company, they didn't take any steps to get that language corrected when they were no longer a non-for-profit company.
Mm-hmm.
That one seems like it's, you know, again, although trust is important, that seems like the more minor of the two. And now the Trustee agreed to settle the charges, and the settlement calls for them to be prohibited from making misrepresentations about the certification and recertification process. They've got to file annually with the FTC on their activities in certain specific areas, including the Child's Online Privacy Protection Act, and they have to pay a $200,000 fine.
Wow. That's pretty significant. And now they're a wholly owned subsidiary of the FTC, essentially. So if you're relying on their certification, you'll probably get a much tougher examination than in the past. Interesting. So one of the kind of routine things you could count on in this area is that if there was any private company that was relatively cooperative with the government when it came to discovery orders. It was the old heirs of Ma Bell, Verizon, AT&T, and the like. And that's really starting to change. We've talked a lot about Verizon's lawsuit, but now AT&T has apparently filed an amicus brief on the standards that the government ought to meet to get location information. Michael, I know you looked at that.
Yeah, this is a case, I think we've spoken about this before. It's it was a robbery case in which the government used cell site location data in its case against the defendant, and it had acquired that cell site location data from a cell phone provider without a warrant. And the 11th Circuit, a panel of the 11th Circuit, held that that a warrant's required for that sort of information under the Fourth Amendment, even though ECPA allows you to get it with a 2703D order. The Fourth Amendment requires more. And the court basically relied on the concurring opinions of the Supreme Court in the Jones case and said that, you know, people have a real privacy interest, at least if the tracking goes on over a long period of time. And the third-party doctrine just doesn't really apply very well here because people don't really voluntarily reveal their cell site location data in any meaningful sense, and certainly not with the expectation that the government might be able to get it without a warrant. So the government then sought rehearing en banc, and the 11th Circuit decided to rehear the case en banc. And AT&T has now filed an amicus brief saying, you know, we agree with the panel that a warrant's required here. And you know, you're right. This is like Verizon's filing a brief in the Microsoft search warrant case. AT&T did in that case as well, as long as other technology companies. And I think certainly since the Snowden revelations, companies are a lot more sensitive about appearing to be fighting for the privacy interests of their subscribers. So we're certainly going to see more of this, I think. And as you say, this is a real sea change from the post 9/11 years when the former Ma Bell companies bent over backwards to assist the government, particularly in counterterrorism investigations.
Yeah, well, one way the government can avoid this is to collect the data directly themselves instead of relying on the phone companies, and that's it looks like as we discussed last week on dirt boxes and stingrays, what the government has been doing, and it's been doing its best as well to make sure that the details of what it's doing and how it's doing it and how often it's doing it are as confidential as possible. Indeed, it looks as though a couple of remarkable developments in that area just this last week. Jason, what's going on here?
So, yeah, one of those developments was in Baltimore and one in North Carolina, and I'm not sure which is the more remarkable, but we'll start with probably the one that's slightly more remarkable in Baltimore. This is a police department I know very well. I was the violent crime chief in the U.S. Attorney's Office in that city for many years, and the case involves a case in the local courts, not the federal courts, and it involves a 16-year-old charged with the armed robbery of a pizza delivery driver, and information apparently gleaned from his cell phone through some unnamed technological device was critical to establishing his connection to the robbery and to a co-conspirator. And there was a hearing on a motion to suppress in the Baltimore City Circuit Court, and one of the detectives on the case was being questioned by a defense lawyer about how the officers obtained information that allowed them to track the defendant to his home, which is where they then got a search warrant and recovered a gun and the cell phone. And the detective wouldn't answer the question. As the court demanded to know how the evidence was gathered, and the detective wouldn't answer the court's question either. The detective reportedly told the court that the officers did not use a stingray, but he said he couldn't elaborate due to a nondisclosure agreement with the FBI, and the court made the cogent observation that whatever nondisclosure agreement the city had with the FBI was not binding on the court, and said it would hold the detective in contempt if he refused to answer. And the prosecutors made the extraordinary decision not to use the evidence at all, rather than to allow the detective to answer the judge's questions. And as I said, that evidence included a gun recovered from the home and the cell phone itself. So it was not an insignificant decision to walk away from the evidence derived from that phone tracking. And that's
that
at least
is a big deal.
Huge deal. And it's at least the second case of its kind in that same court, the Baltimore City Felony Trial Court. where prosecutors have had to choose between using evidence obtained from phone tracking technology and revealing the techniques used to gather that evidence. And I think it also reflects a growing aggressiveness on the part of the defense bar to push back on these issues and the courts.
Well, they found an angle. Of course, they're going to play it.
Exactly. And a growing insensitivity or growing sensitivity on the part of the courts about how this evidence is obtained. And you alerted me not long before the podcast to a case in North Carolina in the Charlotte area in which a Mecklenburg County judge has ordered unsealed a set of 529 orders in criminal cases in North Carolina in which a stingray or similar technology has been used by local police. And the press is just now starting to go through those. But the earlier reports are that in a great number of them, even the local prosecutor had not seen them or been involved in getting the court order. So this is something where the police went directly to the court. And it's an open question that I guess will be addressed as the public can go through these records about whether the law enforcement officers were forthcoming with the court about what they were doing, how the technology worked, and what would be done with the data that was collected, both for the suspects and non-suspects. And the Baltimore case, for what it's worth, I think the judge got it completely right. You know, if the evidence is classified, whether you're in local court, federal court, or somewhere in between, there are methods for dealing with that. And often those methods involve having the court review the evidence in camera and then deciding how to handle it. If the evidence is not classified, and based on the fact that this is a 16-year-old who robbed the Papa John's driver and not a member of Al-Qaeda, I'm guessing it's not classified.
Right.
It shouldn't even be an issue. You know, the government should have to make a showing to the court and should have to, at a minimum, show that evidence to the court in camera so the court can be satisfied that it was obtained in a lawful way and then to decide whether and how it's going to allow that to be challenged. But a non-disclosure agreement is the most ridiculous excuse I've ever heard of.
Yeah. It's remarkable that the Bureau and law enforcement have been so aggressive in trying to protect this. And that's produced, as you'd expect, from the ACLU and others, a determination to pull it into the light. I have to assume that the reason they're doing that is that this is a very productive but very fragile capability, that there is something about this that makes it easy to defeat. You know, like, you know, when you do the crime, turn your phone off. And that once that becomes common wisdom, this device won't really provide much value. That's the only reason I can think of for them to take such an aggressive position.
Yeah, I mean, as a practical matter, I think that whether or not that's their concern, I think it's unjustified as a practical matter, because no matter what, cell phones have sort of become a part of our life like breathing, and that's true for criminals too. And so no criminal is going to have the discipline. No ordinary domestic criminal is going to have the discipline to turn their phone off at regular intervals. Even those who change their phones with great frequency slip up from time to time, or the people who work with them slip up. And so any technique that can be defeated can't be defeated all the time. And but I have to say,
which is worse, to be held up and mugged, or to be held up and mugged with a guy who's talking on the phone?
You know, I have to say his ringtone is going off in his pocket while he's mugging. I've been puzzled for a while about the secrecy surrounding these devices. I've used them in criminal cases when I was a prosecutor, and it's not hard to get the authorization to obtain them. You have to tell the court what you're doing and how it works and what you're going to do with the data, but that's not a high bar. And transparency with the court has never been the wrong thing. And given that these orders are under seal, I can see why you want to keep the technique in the way it's used from criminals, but you don't keep the technique in the way it's used from the courts whose permission you're seeking to use it against criminals.
So here's my other question, Jason Weinstein. Does your work on serious crimes in Baltimore mean that you're actually in the wire somewhere?
I will say this. The Wire is, I think it's fair to say, although an awesome show, based largely on cases that occurred about 10 years before the show's aired.
Aha, okay.
So this is before my time, both.
Well, too bad. If it runs long enough, does that mean there's a good chance that you'll make an appearance? That's
Perhaps.
Great. Jason Weinstein, fresh from The Wire to the Steptoe & Johnson podcast. Now, there's an old country song that I'm very fond of, just its title, How Can I Forget You If You Won't Go Away? The right to be forgotten certainly isn't going away. We did get some more interesting news from Google's chief privacy officer or their global privacy officer, Peter Fleischer, who announced some of the rules that they were using. They aren't big surprises, but two or three things. Google has decided that it's going to apply the right to be forgotten, not just in the EU, but in all of the EFTA countries, Iceland, Liechtenstein, Norway, and Switzerland, which I think makes sense. Those are countries that, on a quasi-voluntary basis, incorporate all of European law into their own body of law. Fleischer also made it clear they're not going to remove links all around the world, only in these European domains, .fr, .uk, etc. He made it further clear that they intend to continue to tell the webmaster that they have dropped a link from their searches because it has a direct impact on the webmaster who's going to lose business, lose clicks if the link is dropped from the search engine. And then finally, and this is nothing but bad news, the Article 29 Working Party announced that it was going to provide common guidelines for dealing with the right to be forgotten requests, which I think will turn out to be a maximalist list of everything that ought to be done. I predict, I may be wrong, I hope I'm wrong, that they will say that it's a violation of human rights not to take down things that Americans can read on the .com websites that Google uses in the United States. But a kind of useful overview. Norway has already confirmed, yep, you got it right, Google. We're going to buy the right to be forgotten. It's odd because the case that they did it in started out as a defamation case, and they've simply turned it into a right to be forgotten case. But the Data Protection Authority said take down this website, this link, where an athlete had been accused of doping. And he says, well, they never proved it, so take it down. I'm not sure this is really in the public interest, but it is what the Norwegian Data Protection Agency decided with respect to the Norwegian search results. And for those who are thinking, well, so far Google has resisted applying this to the news that I read and the searches that I do here in the United States, the drumbeat of pressure on Google continues. A French court has decided to impose about a $1,500 a day fine on Google's French subsidiary, saying, well, you took down a right to be forgotten link in Google.fr, but it's still up in Google.com, and we think there's a close enough connection between you and Google.com that we're just going to fine you until Google.com knuckles under. Maybe they can pay $1,500 a day forever, but sooner or later somebody's going to find a fine that they can't afford to keep paying, and the case for censoring the news and the links that Americans have access to is going to be compelling to Google. And we, of course, have no obvious legal recourse today, which means that the First Amendment is truly going to become a local ordinance applicable only to censorship by the U.S. government. The rest of the world, every government in the world, would be able to find a way to censor search results and make sure that Americans don't see things that those governments don't want. This is not a good development. And now let me turn to our first topic generated by user feedback. Lee Baumgartner of American University asked us to cover the various privacy flaps around Uber, and he asked, I think, early today, and we hadn't quite been ready to cover Uber, but given the fact that it came from Lee, we decided it was worth covering. So I asked Jason and Michael to do a quick look at the, I guess, with two or three different flaps surrounding Uber, everything from their use of what they call a God view tool. It allows them to see everybody who's using their service and where they are and who they are, to their broadcasting the God view at a party, so everybody could be God for 15 minutes. Jason, Michael, obviously there's a judgment problem here, but is there a legal problem?
Well, I don't want to leave the judgment problem too quickly because there's just a wealth of self-inflicted wounds here. That's a bad metaphor, but just an unbelievable amount of bad mistakes that the company has made and shot itself in the foot numerous times. I think there's enough here. We could have a weekly segment, but I would call it Uber Alice. Because it sort of feeds into their view of themselves as just, you know, not being subject to regulations like any other company, not having to worry about fair competition rules and things like that. And they've created a meme now that is very unfavorable. And it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out and whether it really does hurt their business or not. Because, you know,
keep talking, Google's Michael. You know, somebody's going to come after you with a hammer.
Well, I still take the subway, so I'm not so worried about not getting rides on Google, and Uber rather. But yeah, you mentioned this God view tool. You know, they named it. This is not something someone else named. This is like TIA and their the terrorist information awareness logo with the all seeing eye above the pyramid. God view apparently came with an internal picture of Dr. Evil. Showing, I think, some sense on their own part that this was something that people might think was a little creepy. Not only that, they had another related tool called Creepy Stalker View, which allowed them to track customers as they were en route to their destination. And apparently, Uber manager in New York actually showed a reporter who was coming to interview him that he had been tracking her. And then, as you mentioned, another incident, there was a launch party, I think it was in Chicago, in which the executive showed the people at the party that they could track live 30 different, you know, somewhat well-known people. And one of the people at the party actually texted one of the subjects and said, "Are you actually now on Fifth Avenue and 33rd Street in New York?" And when he got the text, he was flummoxed. You know, how did she know? He didn't even know this woman that well. And she proceeded to tell him every block, you know, where he was at that time. And that led to some of these revelations. And it's just astounding that they would be so oblivious to how this would be perceived. So, but the interesting thing is, in terms of the legal issues, if you read their privacy policy, it actually says quite explicitly that they will track where you are in their areas of service, the time of day, and other information. And they say they'll use this information for a variety of purposes, including to enhance or otherwise improve the services, et cetera, et cetera. But like a lot of privacy policies, they bury this amidst a lot of other verbiage. I think, you know, if someone were to sue for breach of contract or some tort claim, you could well get a court saying this is not clear enough, so you didn't have consent to use and disclose this sort of private information. But I think Uber's got a pretty good legal case just based on their terms of service. Of course, they are now going through the process of having a law firm review their privacy policy. I'm sure they will have more promises about privacy and talk about, you know, how they will use this strictly for internal purposes. They won't share it publicly at launch parties and do other stupid things. But it's a pretty good privacy policy, as privacy policies go.
Interesting. So the case would be you should have said that one of the uses you would put this data to is enriching the impoverished social lives of the dweebs that work here.
Yeah, that would be a good one.
Yeah. Is it true that Google has changed its motto to don't be Uber?
That would be, you know, they do well by comparison, although what people fail to appreciate oftentimes is that Google collects the exact same information every time you turn on Google Maps. And certainly if you're using it for directions while you're driving, they have to track where you're going in order to tell you, you know, when to get off at the next exit and where traffic is up ahead. So there are lots of companies that collect this same sort of information. They're just not so stupid about the way they make their uses public in the most unattractive way possible.
Yeah, I've done a lot of work with Silicon Valley companies, and it really is true that there's a kind of sense that, look, we could spend a whole bunch of time thinking about compliance as we're a startup, but it would cost us a lot of money and a lot of time, and it might slow us down. The fact is, if we're fast enough, we'll succeed in the market. If we're too slow, we'll fail. If we fail, no one will come after us because we'll be bankrupt. If we succeed, we'll have enough money to hire lawyers to fight all this stuff. And so there is a pretty relaxed view of compliance, and Uber's probably even more so because they've got all of these local ordinances that they think are fundamentally the result of regulatory capture by the taxi companies that they are fighting very hard and inclined to just override by facts on the ground. So you can see how they develop a culture that was uniquely resistant to a lot of what they would describe as fussy compliance rules.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the Google model, isn't it? But, you know, I think we can offer them a way to do this without getting in legal trouble, and that is to give them free legal services in exchange for equity. Wouldn't we be happy to do that?
It's a deal, Uber. If you're feeling as though you want to improve your situation, just give us a call. That's Michael Vattis at www.steptoe.com.
And keep in mind, he's not the one who called you dweeb.
That was purely hypothetical.
That's
in case
right.
There are any legal
Michael was very respectful of you as opposed to me. So you can include a requirement that I not work on your matters. Okay. What I'd like to do now is turn to our guest. This is Sal Stolfo. As I said, Sal has been working at the Columbia Department for years, and I first met him when we began talking about some of his computer security tools. And I know, Sal, you've been a computer security researcher for quite a while, but what is your background? Did you start out in computer security?
So I started in that area of research with Citibank, and then I had the very bright idea that these techniques of analyzing large amounts of data automatically using machine learning algorithms and applying them to a host of different security problems would substantially raise the bar. I went to DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency of the Department of Defense, and wrote a massive proposal to build a research lab to focus on the concept of machine learning applied to security problems. And they stood up, funded me, and I stood up a laboratory at Columbia in 1996. And since then, I've generated about 45 patents, most of them in the security space. This area of data mining-based or machine learning-based intrusion detection is now pervasive in the security industry. Everybody uses these techniques. And I've also been, for these many years, a consultant to government in a number of cybersecurity problems.
Yeah, 1996 is really early, and you're right. The kind of analysis, we're still finding ways to use computers to look for patterns in the logs that everybody has, and we're still not doing a particularly good job of it, at least in the actual world as the technology is applied. At least that's my impression, is that people still complain that they have more data than they can make sense of.
Yeah, that's a very significant problem. But to the point you made about security in particular, the only hope of dealing with detecting very sophisticated adversaries is to analyze large amounts of data. There's just no other way of doing it and trying to and being effective. But however, the kind of work that I do and I've done with my students and my staff, everything that we invent as a means of detecting, we also find a way to evade that detection and how you would salt databases so that the patterns become very hard to discern. And so this cat and mouse game, we've always taken both a defensive and an offensive posture so that we can improve upon the algorithm.
Let me ask you, can I just stop you there and ask you, you know, when I was at NSA, we had offense and defense, and I always used to say, if you wanted a job done thoroughly, going to the defense guys was probably the right answer. But if you were looking for the best parties, you should go to the offense guys every time. Do you find there's actually a personality difference between people who do well at attack and people who do well at defense?
The creativity that you see in the attack side is always stunning. And defense is, as you just pointed out, it's methodical, it's disciplined, it's really very... very disciplined way of thinking of studying how an attack succeeded. But in order to invent an attack, it's very creative. And I would consider it to be somewhat like chess, where if you have a very aggressive and a very creative adversary, they're going to find new attacks against you that you didn't contemplate. So it is always, security has always been in the advantage of the attacker. The defender, unfortunately, has few tools to try to invent what these creative people will do.
Yeah, although of course, my prejudice is to find ways to turn defenders into attackers and to take advantage of the weaknesses of the hackers' security. Yeah, to my mind, that's the only way we're going to deal with this problem. And I assume you've kind of thought a little bit about that. How do we take defense and use the data we're collecting about people to actually collecting about our attackers to actually identify the attackers?
Okay, this is excellent, and I've gotten myself into quite a bit of trouble for taking that role. So I got to be very, very cautious as a professor and a researcher and an instructor. I have to obviously impress upon my students to be ethical in the work that they do. So attacking the attackers is very dicey, but there are ways of doing it that I think are perfectly legitimate and are representative of the technologies that I spun out of my lab into this company called Allure Security Technology. One of the key things I observed about attackers, time and time again, the defenders rely upon sort of standard security measures to lock them out, prevent them from getting in, but there's just no way that that's going to work. Most of the technologies focus on the network, filter the network, try to isolate the sensitive information inside the organization from the outside. Time and time again, it's evaded. And so security has to be pushed closer and closer to the source of where that information is, the quarry that the adversary is going after. And when you get closer and closer to the client computers in an organization, for example, and your own personal laptop and your own personal mobile, this observation was key, and it goes back to my early work on credit card fraud. The attacker, once they succeed in piercing through the defenses or through the perimeter, it really isn't a perimeter, and they're inside the client or inside the server, it's like casing a joint that you break into. You have to do an inspection to see where things are, where the information is that you want to steal. And it may not be immediately apparent. You log in, and now you have to do searches. And the key observation is, and if you think a moment, each one of you that's listening, how do you search for your tax document that you filed last year? We all create our own file system, our own directory structure. So for us to find our last year tax document, it's very simple. It's probably one or two clicks, and we got it. But if I break into your laptop, anybody breaks into your laptop who doesn't know your file system, they're going to search. And that search behavior is very different than the search behavior of the owner of that file system. Same thing for a corporate server. The point being is the attacker lacks knowledge of the actual environment in which they just pierced. And that's a key defensive strategy we can use against the attacker. Furthermore, when they break into that environment, there's no reason why organizations have to provide nothing but true, sensitive, valuable data. One could litter the landscape with lots of decoys, decoy documents, decoy information of all sorts. Now, this is a more active defense strategy without actually trying to attack the attacker. The attacker now has to decide what is real and what isn't. And that raises the bar. Furthermore, we have a technology, this is one of the inventions, where we can beaconize, I call beaconizing documents. We put information into the document so that if it is exfiltrated and if it is remotely opened, we get a signal that that document has leaked from the organization. So now you have an adversary who has a conundrum. Besides piercing through the perimeter, they now have to search, and their search behavior can be detected as an abnormal pattern of behavior, and whatever they do manage to steal can be marked or beaconized. Let me just address one last thing, this idea of behavior. This is a concept that I proposed to DARPA back in the 90s. I called it behavior-based security. Today, folks call it user behavior analytics, which is a lot of the early work I did. By the way, I have patents on this technology. And what it tends to do, as I was saying, the search behavior that you exhibit, that is the defensive strategy to protect your machine from anybody else. It makes your personal computer truly personal to operate only with your behavior as the key to unlocking it. Now, we'll look at also how the security systems have been architected. They've been architected incorrectly for many, many years. Passwords being the primary credential that we use to gain access to some system. The credential is used when you log in. And then from that point forward, you have an active session. That active session can be hijacked by an adversary. Or somebody could steal your credential, which is the credit card fraud problem when numbers are stolen. Steal your credential, log in, and now the session is active where the adversary can do whatever they please. The technology that I invented, this behavior-based analytical approach, we're continuously authenticating the user to conform to the learned behavior of how they use their system. And then we de-authenticate if the user's behavior changes in any substantial way. We just completed a scientific study with 160 users, and what we showed with our technology is 95% accuracy, meaning we can detect a fraudulent activity or a masquerade activity within 15 minutes with one false positive per week. And the technology can operate on a server, on a laptop, desktop, and most recently we ported this technology to mobile and the mobile case. And the same behavior-based approach to securing a system. Now the equation has changed. We're pushing the security closer and closer to the user and making the adversary work much, much harder now to evade detecting their abnormal behavior.
And the penalty for being in the false positive is maybe you have to engage in a second-factor authentication or something of the sort. It's not as though you're locked out forever. You just have to meet a higher standard of security.
Exactly. So think of it when you access your bank application from a new computer that you buy. You log in with your credential. It says, hold on, I've not recognized this new computer that you have. And now you have to answer some security questions. So that happens fairly rarely. So once a week, being challenged that you have to enter a second authentication. We're now all extremely well-trained with our mobile phones. They lock themselves after 5 minutes, and you have to re-authenticate. And so re-authenticating is something that we're accustomed to. It's not at all operationally a deal-breaker. It's to be expected. In fact, it gives one sense of being protected whenever you are challenged to access your own sensitive data. So I think it's a good thing.
It makes sense.
Not that I would want one false positive an hour, but one false positive per 40-hour work week, I think, is an ideal operational setting.
And it's a penalty for working overtime, I assume, because that's something where you're out of the ordinary behavioral pattern.
Well, if that's not your typical behavior, but when I'm speaking of behavior, I'm speaking of how you use your computer. So if you're working more hours than typical, that's not an issue. The issue is if you're behaving while you're doing that work differently than you usually do, that's what we detect as an abnormality, and that's when we lock the session. That's a very, very good thing, because now, obviously, we're getting closer and closer to the source of the information that the adversary is trying to steal. And if you're at the user level, at the server level, you lock that station, you lock that session, they no longer have free access to that sensitive information. And even for that 15-minute period or 10-minute period, because it's statistically, it really is the same, if they abscond with certain data, that data is also beaconized, and so we'll get a signal that they stole some data, not all data. And so they're it's pretty difficult security wall that an adversary has to evade. Point being is that we've raised the cost for them. Right now they have no cost. When they break in, the data that's there is real data, and they steal it all, or as much as they can. Now the cost is a lot higher, because now they'll have to work hard to figure out what data that I steal, is it real or is it not? In which case, then it's best to go somewhere else where there's an easier victim than one that's using decoys and deceptive active defenses of this nature.
I love this idea. I see a couple of problems with generating false data. If it must be a little bit hard to generate false data that is not obviously false. But if you do too good a job of generating false data that is not obviously false, how do you keep people from actually using it by mistake?
Well, if we're clever about how we generate it, we want them to use it. So, for example, one of the...
Well, you want the bad guys to use it. You don't want the people inside the company to use it.
No, exactly. This is a hard, area of research that I've been working on for about a decade with lots and lots of science behind it. That's called the non-interference property, and there's ways of dealing with this that favors the adversary and not the favors the defender, not the adversary. To be clear, when an adversary is searching a file system, the only thing they get to see are file names, and for them to then look into the file to see what the content is. Touching that decoy and opening the decoy in the file system locks the session immediately. So that's a tripwire. If they just simply take all the files and upload them out, and then remotely they have to process it, those documents signal. Now, the point of an internal person touching one of the decoys, same thing applies. If they touch one of the decoys, it locks the session, and they have to reauthenticate. And if they re-authenticate successfully, no harm done. So that document will not be used in the processing of whatever the business process is. So there are ways of, there's various ways of cleverly dealing with it to minimize any internal mistakes. But the most important is we want the adversary to know, come into my environment and you are going to be peppered with, you better behave yourself because we'll lock you out. And if you have a very short time frame, then you're doing a smash and grab, and you're going to be smashing and grabbing for all sorts of information, and when you take it away, you won't know what is real and what isn't. You might as well go somewhere else or find a different profession.
Yeah, no, that's great, because the current state of the art for these guys is to move the data around inside your network and accumulate it on some relatively little-used hard drive until they've got enough to exfiltrate mass quantities in a RAR file. But I assume that just moving it to an unfamiliar hard drive inside your network is enough to trigger the alarm.
Exactly. As an example, Stuart, in the study that we did with 160 people, we automated the process of distributing the decoys, and we expected people's curiosity to be exhibited, meaning in the first few hours where the decoys were distributed, we'd expect quite a few of them getting touched and hit and opened as people would be curious. That's absolutely true. But then their curiosity decayed very rapidly. And over the course of 2-3 months, they rarely touched, maybe one or two touches to a decoy after they were just forgotten about. The masquerade test, where we had 23 people come in and behave as masqueraders, they were all detected within 15 minutes because they didn't know what was a decoy and what wasn't. So it's a very effective tool and a very effective means of detecting adversaries who, as I said, don't know your file system, don't know your environment, and we're using that against them in order to detect their nefarious activities.
Boy, I bet NSA wishes they'd had this before Snowden started his collection.
Well, that's one of the reasons why I've been given millions of dollars of funding from the government to develop this technology. The company has benefited from these obvious insider problems, and we developed technology primarily with support from DARPA. It is now being transitioned, and we're now commercializing the technology.
This is interesting. It has three values. One, it helps you against hackers who are pretending to be insiders because they actually are inside your network. And then it helps you against actual insiders who have a bad intent. And finally, you can even sell it as a privacy protective device because, for example, Uber could put God mode into this system so that people who were calling on God mode without justification would get caught immediately.
All true. One of the concepts that I talked about at RSA 2 years ago was fog computing to counter the threat we all have from cloud computing, which is the Uber.
Is this like the fog of war? You're introducing the fog of war to the cloud?
You bet. Exactly correct. So you have Dropbox? You have Dropbox on your machine?
Yes. We got rid of it recently because of security worries.
Yeah. Well, with my technology, you can bring it back and not worry about it. The idea is to put into Dropbox, like your local file system, a bunch of decoys. And if too many meaning like two are touched, lock the session. So you can protect the data that's in the fog by not just putting real sensitive data, but also bogus data that's beaconized, and that will protect you. The same is true of social networks where, you know, the kids today put so many details about themselves and their crazy behavior, and we've all heard how companies use that to make decisions about employment. There's no reason why we can't create a fog in social media as well using avatars. So create, you know, three or four different personas of a person. Your friends know who you are and know your physical characteristics and what you really like, so they'll be able to tell who the real avatar is. The others are fake and bogus, and that will tend to protect the user from having their profile stolen.
Oh, I love this. I love this. Does this mean you get to say to your teacher, the principal, your parents, your ex-girlfriend, that wasn't me, that was my evil avatar twin? I have to say, this is bringing the creativity of the attacker to defense. I love it.
Yeah, this is an active way of defending yourself without having to actually shoot bullets or shoot malcode at an attacker. The key thing is to remove the knowledge, the free knowledge that they have. Attack them through information, not through actual, physical or malware attack. And that bypasses all of the issues that you well know. There's one last part of it which I really, really like. No matter what defense is invented and deployed, when an attacker, including an insider, reads a document and may not actually exfiltrate it, they can exfiltrate its content because it's in their brain. And so when they walk out the door, they have the knowledge with them, and there's nothing that you can do about that. No computer security technology is going to prevent a person from memorizing or remembering something. But bogus data can do something about it. And if they're faced with two documents, one real and one false, and both are very believable and plausible, you're essentially also defending the memory that the attacker has of what they read inside your environment. This is a very powerful concept, and we've been working hard to scale it for large organizations. Ultimately, it'll be in your home machine as well. And definitely will be on your mobile.
So you say you've been commercializing this. How many, or can you give me some sense of how it's being used and how it's actually working out in the field?
So large organizations look at this technology as a way of measuring the amount of exfiltration that's going on that they're not aware of. And this is really one of the key powers as well of this beaconized document technology. The many large organizations use commercial DLP, data loss prevention. First of all, I don't know why you guys haven't, the legal profession or the legal industry, attacked these for false advertising, attacked these commercial companies, because it doesn't prevent the loss of data. Data leak prevention is just wrong name for a technology that barely works. It failed.
So should it be called data loss identification? You say, oh boy, you're screwed, or is it not even that good?
Well, they're not very good, and they just give a limited view of what's really being leaked. The technology I'm talking about, I call a data loss alerting. When the document actually left, it beacons back and says, I've been stolen, and that's much more powerful information because it'll also tell you where it went. And data loss prevention does not tell you where it went. But be that as it may, this technology is intended to prevent the theft at the source, where the information is sitting at rest, in an employee-client computer or on the server, so that when access is made to that data locally from a session after a credential has been used, if the abnormality appears in that session, the session is locked. The data now can no longer be exfiltrated. That's a key desiderata, to prevent the loss of the data at the source, rather than essentially getting an alert message in some commercial SIM telling you your data had left, and not much more than that.
Very nice.
By the way, the technology, I want to give you one more example. This will be a very powerful example of how and why this works.
Mm-hmm.
We call the local sensor technology, the user behavior sensor, we call it RUU. It's capital R, capital U, capital U. It you have to spell it every time.
I get it.
RUU. Now, we have a mobile version of RUU, and I want you to think just a moment. You all have applications on your mobile device. And in particular, you may have your bank application on your device. You may be, for example, a customer of BOA, but there's no reason why you can't also have an automatically placed for you Wells Fargo's app and Citibank's app. So now you have three banking applications. You know which of those three is the real one. An adversary who is misusing your phone would look at that and say, well, let me guess, and I'll click on Wells Fargo. That is a decoy. And what we do when a decoy app is clicked on a phone is we lock the phone instantly. We upload information about the event, send an email to the owner of the phone to know that some event has occurred, including a picture of the adversary. And now you have to re-authenticate with the phone using a second PIN. And now if you re-authenticate correctly, no harm done. You accidentally clicked on a decoy app. If you don't re-authenticate correctly, the phone does unlock, but when it unlocks to a decoy state. Everything now that's displayed to the adversary is false. And so we now have the opportunity to feed the adversary as much false information as they want. This is a way of protecting mobile phones. Much of the work that's going on right now in the industry is worried about malware and, you know, stealing data, blah, blah, blah. But one of the biggest threats is people steal phones for the purpose of reading your personal information. And this is a way to defend against, theft of your phone and theft of your personal information. It's also a way to help enterprises who are, you know, developing BYOD strategies, you know, bring your own device, putting all kinds of apps so that you can access the corporate environment remotely, because after all, we're doing most of our business now on mobiles. It also protects enterprises by providing decoy information to anybody who steals our employee's phone. And so again, it helps protect corporate sensitive data from being exfiltrated through the mobile phone using, again, this deceptive active defense decoy technology.
You know, I have to say this reminds me a little of the guys who used to respond to those Nigerian letters by promising to make the payment and asking the party just to go a little north, we'll get the payment to you, until they could send them into a war zone, standing around trying to collect the money, with sending them hopeful message after hopeful message. Oh, just one more trip down the road to just pick a truck driver. We'll pay him when we get to the next city. We promise. You can assure him that he's going to get $100 for carrying you there. And then, of course, stiffing him, getting him in trouble with the truck driver, these elaborate and picaresque adventures that you subject the fraudsters to. That's sort of the spirit in which this whole enterprise has been launched. I have to say I kind of admire it.
Yep, this is the key. It's to raise the cost to the adversary. They have no cost now. But now if they have a very high cost in succeeding and stealing what they want, they'll go elsewhere. Let them go to France.
Yes. Okay, well, where they can quickly be forgotten. So thank you, Sal Stolfo. That was a terrific interview. Very much enjoyed it. Of Columbia University and Allure Software. Before we close up, we usually ask people if they have any speaking engagements, reports, or other releases coming out. Do you have anything you want to plug for our listeners?
So RSA, we should be presenting at RSA coming up. That's going to be in April in 2015. And I'm continuously giving talks and speeches, primarily to government offices, the government meetings. As I said, the government has heavily sponsored this line of work, and we're transitioning now for use across many different agencies in the U.S. government. And next up, as I said, is the corporate world, and that's what Allure Security is now focused on. And we have relationships with various parties planning on giving presentations to various corporate security conferences.
All right. Well, I am my speaking engagements tonight, and by the time you listen to the podcast, it will be over. I am going to be trying to prosecute in one of these weird fictional trials before Justice Alito. I'll be prosecuting Lysistrata for treason to Athens. We'll see how that works out. Actually, we know how that will work out. I will lose. The only question is how badly. The Women's Bar Association has bought an entire section of the theater. I don't think they'll be voting for me. And on December 2nd, I'm speaking to the Health and Human Services Cybersecurity Conference. And I will be talking a little bit about turning the tables on attackers. And Sal, I will use some of what you told me today. I think it's really terrific. So thank you very much.
My pleasure, and thank you for the opportunity to speak with your audience.
All right. As a reminder, the podcast is open to feedback. Send your questions, suggestions for interview candidates or topics to cyberlawpodcast@steptoe.com. If you'd like to leave a message by phone, you can contact us at 202-862-5785. This has been episode 44 of the Steptoe Cyber Law Podcast, brought to you by Steptoe & Johnson. Next week, we will have a guest, Truls Erting, the Assistant Director and Head of the European Cybercrime Center. We hope you will join us as we once again provide insights into the latest events in technology, security, privacy, and government.